The song Light One Candle, composed by Peter Jarl and sung by Peter Paul Mary, is about using peaceful strategies to end the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Like Peter Jarl, the producers of Solutions to Violence would also like to see the Palestinian-Israeli conflict end peacefully. Welcome, friends and neighbors. You are listening to Forward Radio, WFMP LP 106.5 FM, on your radio dial. This is Solutions to Violence, a program sponsored by Forward Radio. Forward Radio is a subcommittee of the Lowell Fellowship of Reconciliation. The producers of Solutions to Violence are Jamie McMillan and Jim Johnson. And our technical engineer is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. I'm Jim Johnson. The following is part of WFMP's Public Affairs Educational Programming. The views expressed are those of the speakers and not the station. If you would like to share your views, you may email us by Googling forwardradio.com and clicking on Contact Us. Thanks for tuning in. We think you are going to enjoy this hour of Solutions to Violence. Many of our listeners may disagree as to who is right and who is wrong in the conflict between those who consider themselves Palestinians and those who consider themselves Israelis. But there is one issue on which we can all agree. The conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians have become a human tragedy, especially for the Palestinians. We don't claim to have all the answers, but we thought if we could look at this conflict from a historical perspective, perhaps we could get a grip on the causes of the conflict and possibly decide if there is a moral high ground. And if so, we wondered, could we determine if one side was more righteous than the other? We believe the moral pathway to ending this conflict comes through peace and fairness.
The second part of the series focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We'll feature a panel discussion led by the University of Louisville's Dr. Russ Vanderbilt and will air on Solutions to Violence July 20th, 21st, and 22nd. For the first program that focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict,
we have invited Ira Gruber to help us better understand the Gordian knot that illustrates the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. Ira has been involved in civil affairs for over 59 years. He has been an organizer, a consultant, and an activist. As an adjunct Bellarmine professor, he has taught civil rights and the history of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He led two peace observer delegations to Israel in 1993 and again in 1996. He traveled to a number of Israeli cities and the Palestinian territories, West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as Amman, Jordan. He lived in Jerusalem from November 1999 through April 2000, traveling throughout Israel and Palestinian territories. Ira was part of a delegation that visited Israel and the West Bank December 14, 2001 through January 7, 2002. He met the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Hanan Ashwari. He has been in the Middle East six times. From 1989 through 1993, Ira Gruber served as the national co-chair of the New Jewish Agenda, a multi-issue organization that had called for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian impasse as early as 1982. Ira, welcome. We are thrilled to have you with us again today.
Thank you, I'd say. Assalamu alaikum, as I said in Arabic. Shalom aleichem, as we say in Hebrew.
Ira, how did you become interested in the Israeli-Palestinian situation?
That's a very interesting route that I took, shall we say. My family comes from Orthodox Jewish stock, what you would call Holy Rollers, although my father was politicized during the Great Depression of the 1930s. I went 5 years to Cheder, to Hebrew school, after regular elementary school. This was in New York City. And going to this Cheder for all those years resulted in two things. Number one, I was bar mitzvah, or what you say, confirmed. And number two, I vowed never to set foot in a synagogue again as long as I lived. That changed. It changed many years later, but that's what I was. Then I became sort of radicalized soon after that. I was 13 years old, and by the time I was 15, I thought I knew everything. There's a story that Mark Twain tells about, he said when he was, I think, 15, he couldn't believe how little his parents knew. When he was 20, it was amazing how much they had learned. That was me. It certainly was me. I got involved in the civil rights movement in New York City, but the struggle was mostly in this, or the main focus was in the South, although racism was all over the country. So I went to Georgia and Mississippi with several groups. I was asked by several African-American activists in the Deep South I said, Ira, you Jewish? I said, yes. They said, and you seem to be a person who's done a lot of reading. Yeah. Would you talk to us about the Israeli-Palestinian situation? Because we want to take stand on international issues.
Really?
I was absolutely humiliated. I knew almost nothing about this situation, and I should have known something about it. So I began reading, and that was in the middle 60s, and I've been reading ever since. I'm, I suppose I'm an autodidact in that regard. One of the areas that really plagued me as a Jew, as a proud Jew, as the son of family that struggled to survive all these years of a people, what plagued me was the Nakba, which is the Arab word for disaster or catastrophe. More than 700,000 Palestinian Arabs fled or were expelled from their homes during the 1948 war. Between 400 and 600 Palestinian villages were sacked during the war, while urban Palestine was almost entirely extinguished. The term Nakba also refers, of course, to the period of war itself and events affecting Palestinians from December 1947 to January 1949. I think that the number of refugees, many of whom settled in refugee camps in neighboring states, is a matter of dispute, or at least people don't know the answer, but maybe 80% of the Arab inhabitants of what became Israel, half of the total of mandatory Palestine, left or were expelled from their homes. About 250,000 to 300,000 Palestinians had fled or been expelled before the Israeli Declaration of Independence in May 1948. In fact, which was named as a casus belli for the entry of the Arab League into the country, sparking the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. There's a lot more that can be said about this, Jim, but I did not know about all of this. I had heard about it maybe a little bit, but I knew nothing, and I was very distraught. I was very conflicted. How do I, as a Jew, person who's proud of who I am, reconcile that with the fact that I felt that what Israel did to the Palestinians was and is a crime against humanity? I've been reading ever since. So pretty much that's how I got involved.
Can you give us some of the history in terms of how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict developed?
Well, let me start with the UN resolution of 1947, since that's a lot of dispute, and then we can go before that as well. UN resolution 181 of 1947 called for partition of what was then called Palestine. There were Zionists and non-Zionists, capitalists and communists, all of whom supported this resolution. This is in 1947. Why? Did the partition plan do justice to Arab claims? No. However, the Holocaust created a changed situation. Yet I'm a dialectician, not a metaphysician. Things change. New information surfaces, as it did in 1978 when Israel and Great Britain released hitherto secret documents. For now, let's first look at the Middle East, home of the three monotheistic religions that call Abraham their father, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They fight among themselves. They battle each other. Sunni and Shia Muslims kill each other. Fistfights among Orthodox, conservative, and Reform Jews battling at the Wailing Wall. Christians throwing punches over who controls access to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You may or may not know this, but the ceremonial key for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I've been there a number of times, was given to a Palestinian Arab family because the Christians couldn't come to a resolution of who should control this ceremonial key. Fistfights. Unbelievable. Christmas is celebrated here in Louisville with lights and prayers and joyfulness. I was in Bethlehem many times, and once during Christmas in 1999, and it was not celebrated this way in Manger Square in Bethlehem. Jesus was an outcast in his birthplace, now a war zone. I have little interest in delving into who was there first, Jews or Palestinians. I don't give a darn. There are two peoples born of our father Abraham, also known as our father Ibrahim, killing each other. For what? I must focus instead, Jim, on greed and on great power chauvinism. We must hone in on two peoples, Palestinians and Jews, two nationalities fighting and cursing and defiling each other and dying for the same piece of real estate. Who was there first, Arabs or Jews? I don't give a darn who was there first. Let's start with the 1800s and onward. The British and other European countries decided to spread the Christian gospel, imperial conquest, Western civilization, and syphilis to other parts of the world. They were up front with their nomenclature in Africa, British East Africa, French Equatorial Africa, the Belgian Congo. They were honest in talking about the near and far east, nearer to Britain, farther from Britain. This was the white man's burden. Conquerors came not just from Western Europe, Jim, but also from the Ottoman Empire, that vast Turkish sultanate begun in the 13th century of Southwest Asia, Northeast Africa, and Southeast Europe. One can't say that the Islamic conquest of the Middle East and Northern Africa was completely benign, yet there was greater tolerance than at the hands of the Christian conquerors, specifically during the Crusades. Whereas European Christians came to liberate the Holy Land and cleanse it of non-Christians, the Muslims tolerated the other peoples of the book, relegating them to second-class citizenship, but at least tolerating them. And by the way, I don't condone second-class citizenship. It was during the period of the Crusades that many Palestinian families converted to Islam. This was mainly because the European Christians did not acknowledge Eastern Christians, Eastern Orthodox Christians, as actually being Christians, nor did their racist ideas allow them to see local Christians as their brothers and sisters. Perhaps this is why modern-day Christians in the Holy Land are overwhelmingly Greek Orthodox. Small communities of Protestants and Catholics are more recent. The contention between Ottomans and Western Europeans. We are now in the early 1900s. The British, the French, the Italians, the Germans all want the Middle East for the oil, for the geopolitical power, to make the world safe for hypocrisy. Excuse me, Woodrow Wilson. The Ottomans want to retain power for the same reasons. What should the British and the other interlopers do to seize control and divide the spoils? Promise the same parcels of land to the Arabs and the Jews. To do this, they needed a mechanism to go after Germany and Turkey. They needed a conflagration. This came to be known as World War I, and it lasted from 1914 to 1918. No, I'm not signing with Germany and Turkey, by the way. The British issued the Debunsen Report in 1915. This report said that Britain, which in the past had backed Turkish control of Arab lands, should now seize all these lands when the war ended. Their interest in India, recently discovered Iraqi oil and other Iraqi resources, had the British drooling. To dominate Iraq, they had to control the sea routes nearby, Basra, Kuwait, the Persian Gulf, the port of Aden in Yemen, and Palestine, especially the port city of Haifa, which is now, of course, part of Israel. So the white man's burden had become more pressing.
So, given this very complex history, considering all these historical facts, is it now safe to say the Jews, who now consider themselves Israelis, have a legitimate claim to the region west of the Jordan River, the land that in biblical times was called the Kingdom of Israel and Judea?
I don't know what the word legitimate means, but maybe what I should have done was to continue with a little bit of a narrative so that we can deal with this now. Maybe I should have not stopped at that point, and then I'll answer your question if I may. The white man's burden had become more pressing. Let's now look at the Hussein-McMahon correspondence, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, and the Balfour Declaration, the only one that I ever heard of. And Jim, I have to go in a little bit to this because we have to understand the context in which the present was a product of the past.
That's right, yeah.
Sharif Hussein of Mecca was the Arab ruler of note in 1915. Henry McMahon was the British High Commissioner of Egypt. If Hussein would support Britain in the war now raging, Britain would create an Arab kingdom he could rule. But there is no honor among thieves. The Arabs claimed Sir Henry McMahon had promised an all-inclusive land package that embraced Syria and Palestine. The British boasted that they had put Hussein's sons in as rulers in Jordan and Iraq, that Palestine west of the Jordan River was not part of the package, ad nauseum. Then we come to the British and French deal known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916. This secret, sinister pact only came to light after the Bolsheviks took over in Russia in 1917 and then let the cat out of the bag. The agreement gave Britain Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine. France would get Syria, which included Lebanon. Russia would collect Central Asia. I would guess that many of your radio listeners had never heard of the Sykes-Picot Agreement before today. I had never heard of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, so I started reading Sykes-Picot. But again, this is how the white man's burden really manifested itself. The Balfour Declaration of 1917 is better known. Lord Balfour, who many feel was no friend of Jews in England and elsewhere, just wanting them to go elsewhere, declared, and I quote, "I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existence of non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country," end quote. So the Debunsen report shows British plans for a wholesale unabashed land grab, no nuance, no subtlety. Sharif Hussein was then promised a piece of the action by Lord McMahon. In Sykes-Picot, the booty would be divided up differently, and the Balfour Declaration would create still another reality. With all of this wheeling and dealing, one simple fact gets lost, Jim. The Arabs of Palestine are indigenous to the area, the descendants of all those who passed through. Where were Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad in all of this? Did the 10 million people who died in World War I really die for a noble cause, for a matter of principle, as President Woodrow Wilson contended? Were any of the treaties religious or ethical in nature, or was it the victors dividing up the spoils of war? Was the mandate system, particularly the British mandate, really anything more than the legal codification of the division of Arab lands? But the elements of religion and nationality were indeed part of the picture. The Jewish people, my people, had suffered and suffered and suffered and suffered. Discrimination, stereotyping, accusations, we were responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. Anti-Semitism may have accelerated as the 19th century turned into the 20th, but it had been part of the Christian relationship with the Jews for centuries. This was evident through restrictions on the occupations Jews could hold, on land ownership, etc. Again, during the Crusades, marauding armies often harassed and often massacred Jewish communities in their midst. In Poland, the Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, etc., Jews could not live outside of certain geographical boundaries. This pale of settlement was a degrading confine for Jews. Most Jews were poor. Some were rich. It did not matter. They were all Jews. For the centuries following the death of Jesus Christ, I repeat, many non-Jews blamed all their troubles on Jews. Pogroms, vicious attacks on Jews began around 1881. In Kishinev, in 1903, 45 Jews were murdered. Many more wounded. Stores and homes were trashed. It is estimated that between 1880 and 1920, 2.5 million Jews fled, mostly to the U.S. But it was not just Eastern Europe that saw anti-Semitism. In 1894, the French arrested and tried for high treason Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jew whose only crime was being a Jew. The Dreyfus trial was rigged. The writer Emil Zola wrote an impassioned work in defense of Dreyfus. Theodor Herzl was a Hungarian-born Austrian and a secular, that is, a non-religious Jew. He covered the Dreyfus trial as a journalist and concluded that Jews would never be safe anywhere but in their own country. He is considered the father of Zionism, that is, the movement for the restoration of the Jewish state. Herzl organized a conference of Zionists in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Herzl sought help even from anti-Semites. Anyone who wanted the Jews out of their hair and would help him was approached. Many people don't know, but he considered Argentina, Sinai, Kenya, Uganda as places. He wrote, for example, and I quote, "Argentina is one of the most fertile countries in the world, extends over a vast area, is sparsely populated, and has a temperate climate. It would be in its own highest interest for the Republic of Argentina to cede us a portion of its territory," end quote, for many reasons, which time does not permit me to elaborate upon in this radio broadcast. He chose the Jerusalem area. So if the truth be known, Theodor Herzl had no interest in returning to the original spot where the first temple and then the second temple was sacked. He had no interest in specific Jewish historical claims. He simply wanted a hermetically sealed entity to protect him from non-Jews. Herzl started the Jewish National Fund to purchase land, the World Zionist Organization as its political mechanism. He felt most Arabs were migrants without ties to their land. But the truth is, Jim, that the Arabs in Palestine were peasants and townspeople whose families had lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And this is why I can't answer the question, who was there first? And even if I couldn't, what's the difference? Herzl tried to show how grateful the Arabs should be for his presence. Quote, "Oh, would you call a man a robber who takes nothing from you but brings you something instead?" End quote, Herzl wrote. A rallying cry of the Zionist movement was, a people without a land for a land without a people. The truth, however, is that there were in fact people there. So if the truth be known, Herzl had no interest in returning to the original spot where the first temple and then the second temple were sacked. He had no interest in specific Jewish historical claims. He wanted a hermetically sealed entity to protect him from non-Jews. Herzl started the Jewish National Front to purchase land, the World Zionist Organization, as its political mechanism. He felt most Arabs were migrants without ties to their land, but the truth is that the Arabs in Palestine were peasants and townspeople whose families had lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I never learned that when I was growing up, not going to Cheder.
Yeah, it's not taught in public schools, no.
No. Herzl tried to show how grateful the Arabs should be for his presence. Would you call a man a robber who takes nothing from you but brings you something instead? Herzl wrote, a rallying cry of the Zionist movement was, a people without a land for a land without a people. The truth, however, is that there were, in fact, people there. They were called the Arab people, and later the Arabs living in Palestine were to call themselves not just Arabs, but Palestinians. But to many Jews, these Arabs did not exist, and now the same. Any serious student of world history cannot but agree that both Arabs and Jews had made glorious contributions in many fields of endeavor. The serious student must also recognize that when the Zionists implanted their state in the midst of another people, they engendered hostile opposition, not only from the Palestinian Arabs, but from all the Arab nations in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. For there ever to be peaceful coexistence, these truths must be internalized and recognized. But such mutual respect does not exist, and our Semitic family is therefore torn asunder. This is not the detailed place for analysis of Zionism. I taught so many lessons, and I couldn't get through all of it. But suffice it to say that Zionists, all of whom agreed on a return to Zion, diverged in their thinking. Many wanted and want now a place for Jews to be safe. I once heard a rabbi say on television that although most U.S. Jews at this time are not about to leave the U.S., there is a good feeling knowing that there is a safe place. Anyone who looks at Israel today and considers it the safe haven for Jews is not facing reality. Zionism did not achieve in all these years the safe haven. Among Zionists, there were and are differences. Labor and socialist Zionists, many of whom helped build the kibbutz movement. Different religious Zionist groups, some hostile to political Zionism. There was the ethical Zionism, as one professor put it, of Ahad Hayam and Martin Buber. And I might say parenthetically, or not so parenthetically, that when I lived in Israel, I lived in a Jewish quarter, and well, I was there a number of times, but when I was there for 6 months, and I would walk along Jabotinsky Street to go downtown and then cross over the Green Line into the Arab quarter, Saladin Street, to take an Arab bus, and there were segregated buses. There were Jewish buses, Arab buses, into the West Bank. Now I don't think you can do that. It's too much security. But the main street that I took was Jabotinsky. Almost perpendicular to Jabotinsky Street, which is a large street, is a tiny street called Ahad Hayam Street. And if I may crush an analogy, that in essence reflects the Zionist movement. Jabotinsky was a neo-fascist, a Jewish neo-fascist, who admired Mussolini and wore the uniform of the fascisti.
Sounds antithetical.
Sounds antithetical, but that's what it was. Ahad Hayam, on the other hand, and Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher, they wanted a land of Zion, but they wanted peace with their neighbors. They wanted no problem. So you had Ahad Hayam and Martin Buber, Ahad Hayam Street, and another school, this revisionist Zionism. Its leaders, this revisionist Zionism, its leader was an admirer of Mussolini named Vladimir Jabotinsky, whose followers included Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, both of whom would later become Israeli prime ministers. Jabotinsky, I am told, wore the brown uniform of the fascists. Oh, you'll have to...
Unbelievable.
There are scholars I met in Israel who say we are now in the period of post-Zionism. This radio show is not the place for that discussion, yet its implications for Israel's future cannot be minimized. So alongside the Jewish nationalism, there was also an Arab nationalism. In 1936, the Arabs rose up against the British imperialism. They rose up against Jewish nationalism. Arab nationalism and British imperialism yielded thousands of dead by 1939.
Yeah.
So what do you do? The British then convened a commission. They issued the Peel Commission report in 1937. It said the situation was ungovernable and recommended partition. By this time, Adolf Hitler was on the march, and soon World War II would begin. As the war was ending, Jewish forces in Palestine began armed resistance aimed at expelling the British. The British could not control the situation and appealed to the United Nations, which had just recently been formed. In November 1947, the UN voted to partition Palestine into three sections, one Jewish, one Arab, and one international, to include Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
Yeah.
This plan had much unfairness to it, and that's part of the problem today. That problem, back then, 66% of the population was Arab, yet they would get a much smaller percentage of the land. The old British mandate called for the opinions of the local inhabitants to be taken into consideration. The majority of this population, the Arabs, did not have their just objections considered. Other Arab nations feared that Israel would be used as a Western surrogate, which of course later turned out to be the truth. There was also concern among Catholics and other Christians that the multi-religious nature of the area would not be respected. It was an impossible situation, in my opinion. The Holocaust had wiped out 6 million of my people, of the Jews, in Europe. In Palestine, there were British imperial designs, Arab and Jewish nationalisms, local Arab regimes that were not representative of the interests of farmers and workers in their countries, to say the least. It would have, to this observer, and in retrospect, been better for there to have been one state, a democratic secular state, but the political exigencies of the time did not allow for that. They were killing each other. The UN resolution passed, creating the two states.
Right.
The following year, Israel declared itself a state. War broke out. Israel was attacked by a coalition of Arab nations. Israel won the war. I could use a lot of time to talk about that. We haven't got the time.
Right.
There are in Israel a number of Jewish historians, called new historians, who claim that the Jewish military forcibly expelled the Palestinians. Forcibly expelled the Palestinians, that they did not just leave voluntarily. I personally believe this to be the case, and this then strengthens the argument for justice for the Palestinian people. And God bless my mother, she would not understand me saying that now.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved my mother. The extreme irony is that the birth of Israel was also the beginning of the tragedy, the Nakba, for Palestinians. Forced into exile, 750,000 Palestinians and now their descendants and the several millions live in squalid refugee camps. If I had time, we'd talk later about the 1967 war and those refugees, but we don't have time. I taught a seminar on this topic, Jim, at Bellarmine University. In 14 sessions, 2.5 hours each, with big reading assignments, I hardly scratched the surface. So the radio interview can be little more than sound bites at this juncture.
Yeah.
But I do the best that I can.
It's a lot deeper than anything you're going to get from public school systems.
That's right. And I have tears in my eyes right now. It's every time. I've talked about this for years. I taught many classes. I've been on. The pain of my cousins, the Palestinians, is great. The insecurity of the Jews is longstanding. Yet we cannot just say there is right and wrong on both sides, Jim. History is written by the conquerors, not the conquered. We must not allow distortions of history to stand. What did it mean for peace when Israeli Premier Ariel Sharon visited the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, in 1999 and said Jerusalem forever be the sole property of Israel? And what does it mean when our neo-fascist U.S. President Donald Trump now says the same thing by moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem? My view, well, let me say, a couple of decades ago, I received an email from a dear Israeli friend of mine in response to information I needed for a lecture. She was a German Jew. She's no longer living. She was a German Jew who fled the Nazis. Others in her family were not so lucky. She lived in England, moved to the U.S., then made Aliyah, permanent immigration, to Israel in 1951. She wrote, and I quote, "This is not the time to ask me such a question, just when I'm wondering whether we oughtn't to leave Israel. Israeli society today is not what Martin Buber dreamed of," end quote. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you, Jim, my view, and this is not original with me, but my view is either we will live together or we will die together.
Considering all the historical factors that you have explained, it does not sound as if the Jews, who now consider themselves Israelis, have an ethical claim to the region west of the Jordan River, the land that in biblical times was called Kingdom of Israel and Judea.
That's a very difficult question to answer. What is a legitimate claim? Very difficult, Jim. Let me give you an analogy, an analogous situation, not exactly the same, obviously, an analogy. In regards to the Indian claims in the United States, the wonderful poet and folk singer Buffy St. Marie, a Native American, had a song, and she said,
Can you remember the times that you have held your head high and told all your friends of your Indian claim, considered their lady, considered their man? Your great-great-grandfather from Indian blood sprang, and you feel in your hearts for these ones. Oh, it's written in books and in songs that we've been mistreated and wronged. But even when Germany fell to your hands, considered their lady, considered their man, you left them their pride and you left them their land. And what have you done for these ones? Has a change come about, Uncle Sam, or are you still taking our land? The government now wants the Iroquois land, that of the Seneca and the Cheyenne. It's here and it's now. You must help us, dear man, now that the buffalo's gone. Well, Jim, the buffalo's gone in the United States, and it's gone in the Middle East, too. What is a legitimate claim? Very, very hard to answer. I don't know who was there first, who lays claim. It doesn't matter to me. There are all kinds of debates. The Assyrians and the Phoenicians and the God knows how many other. I don't know. I just know that both people, for me, both Palestinians and Israeli Jews, have a legitimate claim. It's how you deal with that claim. It's always been in the past, might makes right, and might has made right for the longest time. I will say now that the difference for me, how do you live in peace? What will it take for two people, people of the same book, if you will, people of the same God, to live together in peace? I think both countries, both peoples have a legitimate claim. I do not condone so-called Palestinian terrorist bombings against unarmed Jews, nor do I condone the Israeli government taking vast amounts of land and subjugating Palestinian people and relegating them to second-class status. That, to me, is a crime as well. That's the best way I can answer you.
That Native American analogy is an astonishing comparison. Thank you. Where did religion and nationality fit into this picture, Howard?
Religion. You have the three most important monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. That notwithstanding the importance of the moral teachings. Look what they're doing to each other, Jim. They're killing each other. They're slaughtering each other in the name of God. How do I get my head around that? I don't know. If you test me on facts, I would like to think I would do halfway decent. But if you ask me about the ethical claims, I don't know. What I do know is that the United Nations resolution of 1948 created two states and a third section that was to be shared. And Israel won that war. They won a war. A war was created. Now, when Israel declared itself a nation, as per permission, if you will, of the UN resolution, five Arab armies invaded Israel. Israel was ready for them. They wiped them. They whooped them. But not only did they whoop them, they forced out through the Nakba, the tragedy, 720,000 Palestinians. They forced them into a no man's land. And now you have millions with it, with the children and the grandchildren, however many generations since then. So I don't know what legitimate claim is. The UN resolution, which I think we have to go back to talk about so-called legitimate claim, was supported by both communists and capitalists, by most every country except for the Arab countries who walked out rather than vote. And ironically, every Arab country at that time was headed by monarchs who had no particular concern for the Palestinians, as did Israel have no concern for the Palestinians. So this resolution, there were speeches made by UN diplomats and by Andriy Gromyko, who was then the UN representative from the Soviet Union, later become the prime minister, whatever he was. And what he said basically was similar to what the United Nations, what the United States rep said. He says, other things being equal, his country, the Soviet Union, would have supported a one-state solution where Jews and Arabs can live together in peace, if you're talking about religion, or Palestinians and Arabs, others, if you're talking about nationality, can live in peace. But if the exigencies are such that they're killing each other, and they were killing each other, we support a state of Palestine next to a state of Israel, both with what they call secure and recognized boundaries, both the United States and Soviet Union agreed to that. And they were killing each other. So what else could you do? Now, the reason that Jews wanted a homeland was because they had been pushed from pillar to post God knows how many centuries in Europe and elsewhere. But if you implant a state in an area with people who are hostile to you without even conferring with them, you're bound to have difficulties. Amongst Zionists, there were two kinds of Zionists. And maybe I went into this earlier. I don't remember. I guess that's the best way I can answer you as far as the the Jews are concerned, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, well, the Palestinian leaders, many of them were progressive and many of them were not. I've gotten into an argument with a Palestinian friend of mine, a dear friend, because I said that the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the religious leader, was a collaborator with Adolf Hitler. He lived in Germany during the World War II, and he was an absolute damn collaborator. So they didn't have clean hands either. And I'm not saying it to say a plague on both your houses, but just to say that you have to make a concrete analysis of the concrete conditions that pertain. So again, I'm sorry that I have to be this long talking about the area of legitimacy. I don't know what legitimacy is. I do know that Mike makes right. I wish I could be better.
Okay, Al. Considering that rather complex explanation, understandable, it has to be that way, which culture, the Israelis or the Palestinians, is most responsible for this conflict, this humanitarian crisis?
Well, what I can say is that the Jews who consider themselves Zionists, and most Jews did not consider themselves Zionists until after World War II, when 6 million of my people were wiped out, I would say that when the UN resolution passed, creating two states and a third entity, the Arabs did not go along with it, and the Jewish leaders, not the Jewish people, the Jewish leaders used this as a way to take land that didn't belong to it. They didn't just take the land that was designated by the United Nations. They began an expansion which continues to this day. If you stuck a gun to me and said, you must take a side.
Well, that's what I'm doing.
Okay, well, I would say, I love you, Mom, but you cannot just win a war and drive 762,000 Palestinians into a Nakba, into the tragedy, to force them off their land. I would say that Israel was wrong, but that doesn't mean that everything that the Palestinians did was right. In the situation that pertained following the war, there were some atrocities perpetrated against the Palestinians that were unbelievable. The most famous, or maybe I should say infamous, was the tragedy of Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin was a small Palestinian village, and the Jewish army that went in there wiped out God knows how many people. They shot them to death. They forced them out. They created such a fear that many, many other Palestinians, not wanting to face the same fate, they fled. Now, does this mean that I justify and I like all the things that the Arabs did? No. Nor that I justify what the Arab rulers wanted? No. But as hard as this is for me to say, and it is hard for me to say this, all the learning that I had when I was growing up in Cheder, in Hebrew school, to get bar mitzvah, all the stuff that I learned about the Jewish travails, find it greatly troubling for me to have to say this. But from my study, and there are people who are far more learned than I, and that's not false modesty, from all the studying that I've done, the Israelis committed an absolute atrocity in doing what they did in stealing Palestinian land, and they continue with these atrocities by continuing to take Palestinian land. As we speak, bulldozers are tearing up Palestinian villages and Palestinian homes. And they'll appeal, and most of the time the courts rule in favor of bulldozing. Every once in a while, it's the other way. Right now, as we speak, there's a Palestinian area in Jerusalem, in the old city, that is being bulldozed day after day for the purpose of dispelling the Palestinians and including Jews in these neighborhoods. And to me, it's an atrocity. It's a crime against humanity.
Okay. All right, Ara. In a nutshell, what decisions could the Israelis have made that would have avoided this conflict?
I think that after Israel won the war, and they showed, in 48, and they showed tremendous military superiority, they could have reached out to the Palestinians, or to some Palestinians, and said, let's make peace. Instead, they wanted to fortify the capture of land that didn't belong to it, and that's the problem.
As you pointed out, Ara, your own mother supported the Israelis in this conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. You emphasized she was heartbroken. Your words, when she discovered you empathized with the Palestinians. What changed your mind and caused you to decide to support the Palestinians and oppose the Israelis, a people who shared your faith and your cultural heritage?
As I began to develop politically, particularly in wanting to fight racism in the United States, I began to question everything. I mean, everything. And I remember it was either in Georgia or in Mississippi, and a couple of African-American colleagues of mine in the civil rights movement came up to me and said that they, I think it was SNCC at the time, but it may have been another organization as well, it's only 50-some-odd years, hard to remember. They want to take positions on international affairs. Would I be willing to talk to them about the Israeli-Palestinian situation? They want to know. And I was absolutely humiliated, Jim. I knew almost nothing. This is the 1960s. I knew almost nothing about it. And I told them I couldn't. I was not able to do it. And I said to myself, all the studies that you've done about religion and Judaism and your bar mitzvah, there has to be something else you have to begin. So I began to read. And I became, I suppose, an autodidact. How much of an autodidact? Maybe it's a question of what I became. And the more I read, Jim, the angrier I got at what was being done to the Palestinians in the name of the Jewish people. I could not abide that. Tears in my eyes now. I'm usually not at a loss for words, but I'm at a loss for words. That's what propelled my interest. I was never able to tell my mother exactly how I felt, and I loved my mother to death. I couldn't do it. My mother was one of six children. You know, they all had kids except for one. And I remember as a boy, we'd have these family reunions or particular religious celebrations or Thanksgiving. And as a young kid, we were served first and we could go into the other room and watch football or whatever else kids did at the time. And I miss that. Now, they're no longer living, my aunts and uncles. They're all gone and my parents are gone too. But I really wish that I could forget this other stuff and just enjoy myself. There is a technique in acting or in the way you look at plays called suspension of disbelief. For example, I went with a woman once to see the play Miss Saigon, and I really enjoyed that play. And this woman came out and she gave me the business. You're taking me to this, took me to this terrible play, and look what the Vietnamese people. Well, I was able to suspend that disbelief in the atrocities. Same here. I could deal with relatives if I had to by suspending the disbelief about what Israel was doing to the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. That's the best I can say.
So what changed your mind was doing historical research and finding out what happened based on the research that objective historians had done.
That's correct. And it was impelled by my becoming more and more progressive, becoming more of an anti-racist and trying to understand what sexism was and homophobia, etc.
Okay. With a few exceptions, the United States has been a steadfast ally of Israel during this conflict. Why?
The United States, in my humble or not so humble estimation, is an aggressor imperialist country. It has done terrible things to people all over the world. Israel has gone along with just about everything that the United States has allowed, and in fact has acted oftentimes as a surrogate, whether it be in South Africa or elsewhere. Israel has been complicitous in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. The assistance that it gave to the South African government is nothing short of an absolute shame, a shanda, as they say in Yiddish. It's tentacles in Latin America and elsewhere. It's training of mercenary armies. The United States has been complicitous and sometimes led these invasions all over the world. This is my country. I love my country, but it's not my country right or wrong. My country is wrong, and Israel is wrong in going along with it. If you and I pull a bank robbery, and I'm sitting in the getaway car, and you go into the bank and you shoot the guard, we both get the death penalty, even though I had nothing to do with it.
Some say that because the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians reached back to biblical times, a resolution is almost impossible. Many said the same thing about the conflict between modern-day Israel and Egypt. But in 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, the Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin agreed on a framework for peace between Israel and Egypt and a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. That agreement became known as the Camp David Accords. Since the Camp David Accords, Egypt and Israel have peacefully coexisted. In order to reach a settlement, will the Israelis and the Palestinians have to cut their ties to claims that came from the biblical past?
The Camp David Accords, the first one and the second one, I don't know how much amity resulted from all of that. I do know that there was not the overt killing, but Anwar Sadat was no angel in all of that. That's a whole long discussion, which I don't know that there's time for today. Maybe we could do it another time. Suffice it to say that Camp David did not do justice to the Palestinian people. They are not fighting each other. But Egypt did a lot of things that were complicitous with Israel. For example, Gaza. I was in Gaza maybe 10 years ago on a demonstration. Well, we tried to get into Gaza. We couldn't do it from Israel, but international from all over the world went to Cairo. And we tried to get into Israel, and the Egyptians would not let us through. They let a few people through, but most people not. Egypt had made these deals with Israel. They permitted injustice to continue to be perpetrated against the Palestinian people. So, although you're correct, there was not outward fighting and killing between Egyptians and the state of Israel, or Egypt and the state of Israel. There was no peace. There was no justice. No.
Okay. The singer-songwriter Marvin Estonia stated, at some point in the future, Man will look back at war the same way we now look at lynching. It is easy to take a particular side and dig one's heels into the sand. It is hard to maintain the equilibrium of peace. Ira, what's your plan for peace between Palestine and Israel?
First, I like your quote, looking at war. How did you say it? Looking at war like...
Looking at war the same way people...
Look at lynching.
At once looked at lynching, yes.
Yes. I think that lynching, there's no question, no doubt, that lynching is a crime against humanity. It's an abomination. I think that war is an abomination too, but sometimes there is just reasons and sometimes there are unjust reasons. As you know, I have great respect for FOR, but I'm not a pacifist. I accepted nonviolence as a tactic during the civil rights movement, and I got the living, you know what, whooped out of me. But I would have fought in World War II. My uncle fought in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. So I would like to look at war like I look at lynching, and I do. It's no good. But if one people or one side or one entity or one coalition is committing overwhelming atrocities against others, they must be stopped. I wish I could say otherwise. I'm too old and fat and nearsighted to fight anybody. I don't want to fight anybody. But I don't think that you can simply say it's wrong and you must stop it. It has to be stopped, whatever means you can stop it. And I would hope, please God, that we can stop things in a peaceful way, because I'm a peaceful person.
So do you have an idea about what that path might look like if there was a peaceful way to do this?
I know what I would like to happen, but I don't know if that way is going to be. I would like to see the Israelis and the Palestinians sit down and look at the issues. The main issues of contention are the issue of Jerusalem, the issue of borders, and the repatriation of Palestinians who had been forced from the land. The reason that I am not as optimistic as I would like, Jim, is because these three areas are areas of contention, and negotiation means that you go in there, you and I are negotiating about something, and I have a minimal demand and a maximal demand, as do you. I don't tell you my minimal demand, what I'm going to accept. I ask for the most, and you ask for the most. Hopefully, we being rational people and good people, we come to a compromise. Look what's happened with those three main things. Look what Donald Trump has done around Jerusalem. He's moved the embassy, the U.S. embassy, to Jerusalem, is to say, this is the state of Israel, we're going to negotiate. One of the main issues is not going to be negotiated. Look at the issue of borders. Where are the borders? Israel, probably the only country in the world that I know of, maybe there are others, that has never defined its borders, never. If you don't have defined your borders, how are you going to have peace? You can't do it. Then there's the issue of the Nakba, which is the Palestinian War for Tragedy, the Arab War, the forced removal of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their native lands, being dispersed into many other countries in the Middle East, and being put in these horrific refugee camps. And now you have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren in that same area. There is no discussion about repatriation. There is no discussion about what you do with all of this. Even to the point of Israel saying, we admit we've done wrong, we'll accept some people back, but not others. I wouldn't accept that phraseology. But even that minimal thing, they won't do. Going back to the issue of borders, I've never heard of maybe Pakistan, when they had that thing with India, the borders weren't defined, they were two separate parts, but I don't know enough about that history to say it with any degree of... I can't think of any place else in the world or countries that Israel refuses to define its borders. Because as we speak, some house is being demolished, a Palestinian house by the Israelis. There was an American woman, if you'll recall, a number of years ago named Rachel Corey, who went with other people who were pacifists to try to stop the Israeli bulldozing of Palestinian homes. And how was she rewarded? The Israeli bulldozer went right over her body. And to make sure they did the job, they went back over the body the other way. Never has there been justice in that situation. Never has there been a call for justice by the United States. So if you're dealing, there are many other issues, but these are the main ones to my knowledge. The issue of Jerusalem, the issue of borders, and the issue of dealing with the Palestinians who are forced off their land. Unless these issues are dealt with in a concrete, systematized way, you'll never have peace. There will never be peace for the Jews until there's justice for the Palestinians. And there'll never be justice for the Palestinians until there's peace for the Jews, both. Going back to that poem or that song by Buffy St. Marie, when a war between nations is lost, the loser we know pays the cost. But even when Germany fell to your hands, consider their lady, consider their man, you left them their pride and you left them their land. What have you done to these ones? Is there pride? Is there pride among Palestinians? Or is it a matter of simple survival? In Gaza, recently, there were killings of unarmed Palestinians by the Israeli military. Gaza, I have been to Gaza. Gaza is an armed camp. Around Gaza, I should say, is an armed camp.
and there are very few weapons that Palestinians have. There are some. If you are a Palestinian fisherman and you venture more than 3 miles out into the sea, you will be shot and killed by the Israeli military, by the Navy. What do you call that, if not a concentration camp? As much as I would like to see reasonable people talk about justice, I'm not seeing it, Jim, and it breaks my heart.
So, Ara, between the Israelis and the Palestinians, what's your plan for peace here?
The first part, and this is not false modesty, I don't know. Having said that, I will give you a sound bite, and I have to apologize for the sound bite, but that's the way it is. There are three main issues, as I see it, that have to be negotiated for there to be peace. There needs to be a settlement around the issue of Jerusalem. There needs to be a discussion about defined borders. And there needs to be a discussion about the dispossession of 762,000 Palestinian people after the 1948 war. Unless and until those issues get discussed, the situation, the status quo ante, will be the way it is. The issue of Jerusalem, Donald Trump just moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, saying, to hell with the Palestinians. The borders have never been defined. How can you have peace if you don't define your borders? Israel has not defined its borders because it wants to expand more and more into the territory. And the issue of the dispossession of 762,000 Palestinians and now their children and grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, must be settled. It may well be that all the refugees won't be returned, but at least to be the right of return has to be, and the issue of compensation must be discussed. Unless and until those discussions take place and a resolution comes, Jim, there will never be peace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to a conversation with Ira Gruber, a longtime civil rights activist, a union organizer, and a university professor, and a familial Jew. Most would believe that one who grew up in a Jewish family instilled with Jewish heritage would be empathetic supporter of the Israelis in this conflict that has caused so much death and destruction. But that is not the case. Our grouper is instead concerned about the lives of the Palestinians, concerned about the justice that has eluded the Palestinians. An inquisitive learner, an inquisitive listener might wonder, why has Ira adopted a perspective that seems antithetical to his upbringing? I believe Ira has empathized with the Palestinians because he has seen firsthand the suffering so many of them have endured. But I also believe Ira's change of heart occurred because he has taken the time to do the careful historical research. In this case, historical facts documented by objective historians reveal a different conclusion. Like any good historian, Ira changed his perspective so that his views match the facts documented by objective historians. Ira, have I got that right?
I would like to think so. What I think, when you talk about change my views, I don't know that I ever had a view that supported Israeli aggression. I changed my view of just supporting Israel right or wrong. But yes, you have it right.
Okay, Ira, thank you. One more question. For those who would like to read more about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, could you give us the names of several books or other documents?
Yes. A very thorough book is called Palestine and the Arab-Israeli Conflict by Charles Smith. Very thorough. It has all kinds of documentation. A second is The Iron Wall by Avi Shlaim, A-V-I Shlaim, S-H-L-A-I-M. He was one of a number of Israeli historians who in the 1980s went to the British archives, were allowed to go to the British archives, and they called these Jewish historians new historians because they said that there's proof that the Palestinians were forced out, they didn't just leave voluntarily. There are many other books, but I would also recommend a video that you can get download on YouTube called The General's Son by Miko Peled, M like in Mary, I-K-O Peled, P as in Peter, E-L-E-D. He is, in fact, the son of an Israeli general who supports justice for the Palestinians, and he's made an incredible video. You may not agree with everything. I agree with 99% of it, but you will find it very stimulating.
Thank you. We are delighted that Mr. Gruber has joined us here on Solutions to Violence. This program will be repeated at a later date. Check our forward video broadcast schedule for a listing of times. For more information and a schedule of programming that will surprise and delight you, Google www.forwardradio.com. www.thefaithfulmovement.com and click on Broadcast Schedule. You may respond to us with your thoughts and suggestions by Googling forwardradio.com and clicking on Contact Us. We would love to hear from you. Until next time, we are Jamie McMillan and Jim Johnson, your host of Solutions to Violence. Technical assistance has been provided by Carolyn Brooks Johnson and Ever Britton. The producers of Solutions to Violence believe that learning history documented by objective historians goes a long ways in terms of helping us solve conflict without the use of violence. As the Harvard historian George Santanana points out, those who can't remember history are doomed to repeat it. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you next time.